From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I always had an entrepreneurial gene. Like I said, my mom owned a business and trade school in the 80s and 90s, and my grandmother had a candy shop way before I was born in the 60s and 70s. I've always known since college that at some point I wanted to strike out on my own, and I started becoming jaded myself with the music industry, how everything was kind of imploding on itself, how every year there was a time period where this company was merging with that one, and people were worried about if they were going to be able to keep their jobs. Also, just as being a marketing person, they budgets dried up. And so in my personal opinion, if you are a marketing person who can't do anything because your hands are tied by a diminishing budget, you're not going to be creative anyway. Me personally, one thing I always wanted to be was I always wanted to be free, not afraid. I wanted to be fearless. I wanted to not be afraid of trying something different. I want to be a person who takes risks.
Shantae Bacon, founder and CEO of 135th Street Agency, a communication and experimental marketing firm that specializes in campaigns reaching the youth consumer and business professionals. Bacon has built up an award-winning communication firm from the ground up. Starting in 2005, when she was still a marketing director with Island Def Jam Music Group, 135th Street Agency has grown to work with A-list clients like Disney, Sony Pictures, OWN, and Paramount Pictures. Bacon's effective marketing and PR strategies has delivered impressive results. The success of various campaigns she has led during her career catapulted her to an elite list of accomplished professionals in entertainment. She has received numerous accolades for her work, including recognition as one of PR News' top women in PR, Ebony's 2014 Power 100, and Jet Magazine's 2013 40 Under 40 in Business, and most recently, Ad Age 2016 Women to Watch list. I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America and the beginning of our 46th season. On this week's program, Shantae Bacon, owner and CEO of 135th Street Agency, In Black America.
We do have a mainstream capability and mainstream sensibilities. The only thing is that, especially if you want to be competitive in the workplace, you have to fill a void,
okay,
a niche that is necessary. And so the majority of the clients that are going to hire you from film, television, they're always going to try to hire based on urban engagement, and then you can, when once you establish the relationship, you can go a little bit further and show them that you have a mainstream capability. A lot of people, even after you show it, they don't care, they don't want to see it, they don't want to know about it, that they're territorial, they're like, that's my space. So, you know, you just get in where you fit in and you prove the value.
Shantae Bacon has always had an entrepreneurial spirit and is an award-winning communication leader and founder and CEO of 135th Street Agency. She has often gathered inspiration from her mother, who she watched handling business ever since she was a little girl, growing up in Jamaica, Queens. Bacon grew up in the same neighborhood that produced future hip-hop legends Run DMC and LL Cool J, so it's not surprising that her career has been rooted in the music industry. As a marketing major at Hampton University, she became a college rep with Island Def Jam Music Group, making such an impression that the company held a position for her when she graduated. At Def Jam, she became senior marketing director. In 2002, Bacon started her own agency while still working full-time. In 2004, she left her comfort zone and her dream job to create her own public relations firm, the 135th Street Agency. Her risk has paid great dividends. Her clients include Sean Combs, Revolt TV, OWN Network, Disney, Sony Pictures, Paramount Pictures, and BET, just to name a few.
I was born in Jamaica, Queens, and raised in Jamaica, Queens, New York. And I moved to Harlem about 17 years ago, so I'm now a Harlemite.
Tell her, what was like growing up in Jamaica, Queens?
Growing up in Jamaica, Queens at the time when I grew up there was a little traumatizing. There was a really bad moment in America back in the 80s called the crack era, which was completely man-made and by design, where the federal government was funneling drugs into local black communities, drugs and guns. And let me not say the federal government, but I will say that there have been certain people who were, while working for the CIA, who have been exposed in many documentaries for selling drugs and guns and making connections between people like Supreme, Fat Cat, Freeway, Ricky Ross, Rich and Porter. I mean, Rich and Rich Porter and I'm forgetting his name, but those people are the ones that, you know, that designed the crack era that decimated black neighborhoods all over the country. And coming of age during that time was difficult. I saw not a lot of positive role models in my neighborhood. Lots of poverty, devastation, lots of drug use, and people who were selling drugs, and a lot of young men who did not make it into adulthood, and many who are still serving 15 and 20 year sentences because of the crack era. So not a lot of great examples, but I'm a living, breathing example of what can happen when you have a solid foundation inside the home. Outside the home can be going crazy, but as long as inside the home you have parents who are steady, who are focused, who are raising their kids to the best of their ability, instilling core values and emphasizing the importance of education, then the outside circumstances really don't matter. Because I had a dad who was a New York City bus driver. He was a New Yorker his entire life, always a blue-collar worker, raised a family of four. I mean, a family, a wife and four kids,
mm-hmm.
On a bus driver's salary, bought a home in the 1970s before I was even born. And, you know, he raised a family on a blue-collar salary, which is probably unrealistic today. But his influence and the way that he did not make it an option to not be my best, most excellent self and always push myself to be better and always bring home the best grades I could possibly bring home. If I came home with an A-minus on my report card, I would come home crying, like, because I knew it. I was going to get it. And he'd be like, what is this? I know you can do better. Don't bring this to me. I don't want to see it. Go back and bring me better. And so I was like, oh, God. All my classmates would be like, why are you crying? Look at all the report cards. And I'd be like, because y'all don't know what I got to go home to. So, yeah, I used to think he was crazy when I was younger, but he's 1,000% responsible for what I've been able to make of my life, absolutely. And my mom was a strong female role model who owned her own business in the 80s and 90s. And she was always a career-driven woman who raised a family and was always a person who had the highest integrity and self-respect for herself and also, you know, did not accept disrespect or less from anybody else.
What was it about Hampton that attracted you to that institution?
My best friend's cousin at the time went there. And she said, hey, they're doing a college tour. You guys should come on the tour. We went on the tour, and I went to Hampton, and literally, I know this sounds terrible, but I went to, like, my first college party there where the walls are sweating and everybody's dancing, the music is going, and it's going on all night, and I was hooked. I was like, I've got to go to this school. That's how it happened.
And you decided to major in marketing?
Yes, I did. Actually, I had always wanted, marketing is something that I've always been good at and could not explain it. So when my mother, she used to have these business trade schools, she started out in our basement and then she went into the Chase Bank on Jamaica Avenue and she went upstairs from them. She rented office space. And when she had her school, I would say things like, why don't we think about offering a marketing where, you know, for the holidays, if you register before Thanksgiving, you get a free registration to give one of your friends for Christmas. And she would be like, what? Oh, and she'd look at me like, well, little girl, where are you getting this from? And so I don't know, it's just something that I've always had an interest in. And all through high school, I thought I was going to be a teacher. Then I thought I was going to, she was stressing to me that I should be an attorney. She'd always say, you're too smart for that. I want you to be an attorney. But I wanted to be in the music business, and she thought I needed an exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, the music business? She was like, you're too smart for that. And so she didn't believe in it. She even had me talk to our pastor. He's deceased now, but she tried to have him convince me not to do it and all of that. And then once I started getting some traction, building relationships and building a name for myself in the music business, she liked the idea.
I know that's right. What was it like working at Def Jam?
Def Jam was like a military-like experience for anybody who is in marketing and PR. It was like boot camp. I was blessed with some mentors and bosses that wanted to teach me, empower me with responsibility, wanted to promote me, and that would be Kevin Lyles, Leo Cohen, and Julie Greenwald, Suzanne Bird, Shanita Floyd. Those five people really took me under their wing and taught me and embraced me and held me responsible. There would be times, I mean, yeah, this is way after my dad passed away, but yeah, I didn't start working with them until 5 years after he passed, but they stepped in where he left off, just holding me responsible for everything and making sure to push me outside of my comfort zone and not accepting less than the absolute best that I could do.
Thus far, who has given you the best advice?
Let me see. I have several mentors who give good advice all the time. So I would say Sheila Eldridge. She's one person who I interned for many years ago when I was 19 years old, and she always gives sage advice. I spoke to her not even a week ago, and we talked, I believe it was out at the Essence Fest, about just reconnecting for lunch, and she always has great advice. I live for the opportunity to get a one-on-one conversation with her. Kevin Lau is always a person who gives good advice. And to be honest with you, I am one of those people who seeks advice from a lot of people, so I wouldn't say it's one person.
When you were at Def Jam, what were some of your responsibilities?
So over the time I was there, I had five different jobs. I had six different jobs. I was promoted five times.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my jobs were focused on experiential marketing, retail marketing, creating incentives for people to continue purchasing their music at the brick-and-mortar stores, because
mm-hmm.
this was when actual retail stores started to die a slow death.
Right.
People weren't going into the record stores anymore to get music. They were getting it from the Internet or from bootleggers and people like that. So in the early part of my career, in the early part of my time there, my task was to find marketing incentives to keep people coming to record retail. And then it evolved into more of an overall marketing capacity, where for Kanye's first album, College Dropout, for Ludacris's album, Chicken and Beer, for Method Man's album, the fourth album he had, and Ghostface and several other artists, it was to manage the overall marketing, the creative, the marketing strategy, coordinate with the different departments. So that was pretty much it then.
We see the public side of these individuals, Kanye and Jay-Z. What are they like behind the scenes when they're actually running their businesses and brands?
There was a lot of different artists that I worked with over the years. And I would say, as your question, what is the experience like? Or
yes.
How do you manage a brand? I mean, if you're lucky enough to work with an artist that is business-minded and you see the passion that they bring to building a brand, that is a blessing. A lot of people feel like, I'm famous, I'm a celebrity, I'm the talent, you should do all the work, and then you almost have to protect them from themselves on a daily basis because the decisions that they make work against their best interests. But, you know, I would say everyone's different. And also, everyone's different at different points in their career. They are not the same person every year. And and any kind of person with any fame or celebrity, that person usually is in their head a lot, because it just is a little kink in the armor. They usually just are in their head. They're in their emotions. They really care about what their fans think about them and what people who criticize them think, even though they pretend like they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Also, think about the burden that it takes to get on stage or in front of people and become someone else every day. That's an incredibly difficult task, because the average person, first of all, most of them, who they are on stage is not who they are in every day in the house or in their everyday lives, because that wouldn't work for anybody.
Right.
You have to be a normal human being in human interaction every day, and especially in the world of business. I find that a lot of them have a creative gene, but usually that negates the business gene. Rarely do you find somebody who is a great creative and they're killing it in the business world without making crazy decisions. Because in the business world, it brings a lot of baggage, a lot of BS, a lot of, you know, politics and red tape and, you know, just frustrations. And when you see how other people handle themselves in the world of business and some of the things that are unfair that take place, all of that drains a person's creativity, which is why I think that if a person, when you sometimes you'll see artists that start to get jaded, frustrated, despondent. They feel like everybody's against them. They complain a lot. And then they stop being able to create good albums. And it's because all of that hurt and frustration and narcissism, it all starts to kind of implode on itself, and it robs the creative gene. We've seen some really high-profile examples of somebody who's gotten their heart broken or who has been disappointed or who lost a relative and could no longer be that person that everybody fell in love with.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Shantae Bacon, founder and CEO of 135th Street Agency. Ms. Bacon, what led you to strike out on your own?
I always had an entrepreneurial gene. Like I said, my mom owned a business and trade school in the 80s and 90s, and my grandmother had a candy shop way before I was born in the 60s and 70s. I've always known since college that at some point I wanted to strike out on my own, and I started becoming jaded myself with the music industry, how everything was kind of imploding on itself, how every year there was a time period where this company was merging with that one and people were worried about if they were going to be able to keep their jobs. Also, just as being a marketing person, budgets dried up. And so in my personal opinion, if you are a marketing person who can't do anything because your hands are tied by a diminishing budget, you're not going to be creative anyway. Me personally, one thing I always wanted to be was I always wanted to be free, not afraid. I wanted to be fearless. I wanted to not be afraid of trying something different. I want to be a person who takes risks. If anybody out there has read Kevin Lau's book, Make It Happen, the chapter about guts was started with the story about my career experience, and he said Shantae Bacon always has guts, and I always was flattered by that, but the truth is I always was a person who was never afraid to try something at least once because you never know what you're going to get. There are a lot of people who fight change. They don't like new situations, and I never wanted to be that person.
Who was one of your first clients?
The U.S. Postal Service.
And how did you get that contract?
When we first started, my business partner and I created a huge folder full that we called a company press kit, and we took that around to every conference we possibly could, the Moby Conference, the Black Enterprise Entrepreneurs Conference, this conference, that conference, and we happened to sit down next to a guy who introduced himself, and his name was Roy Betts. He worked at the U.S. Postal Service in the PR department, and he introduced us to the people who could use our services, and within six months, we had a contract. A woman named Monica Hand, who she wanted to hire us because she was new in her gig and she wanted to do something to introduce herself to Black media.
When you have a client that comes in and wants you all services, what type of discussion do you all have prior to coming up with a campaign?
We have a vetting process.
Okay.
So I have a person on the team who, if somebody reaches out and says that they want to hire us, she has the initial conversation with them, vetting exactly what they want and if it intersects with what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of people who don't know what PR means, but they think they need it.
Okay.
There's a lot of people who aren't really clear on where they are in their career and if it's time for PR and marketing. And then there's people who insist that they want PR and marketing, but they have no money to spend, so they just want you to be okay with their celebrity and fame. and that's your payment. And so I'm never with that. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, something where we have to just see if it's a good fit first. A lot of people think that you'll be romanced by the fact that they say they want to hire you, and the first thing they say is that they want a proposal. And I always tell people we don't do proposals anymore. We've been down that road. So, you know, at a certain point, you have to get to the point where you stop constantly proving yourself. As African-American entrepreneurs, you never stop proving your value over and over and over and over and over again. If you can't Google us and see everything you need to see about our capabilities and the kind of work that we are capable of, I don't know what to tell you.
I understand. I read that you all said you're not an agency that only targets African-American people?
Yes, that's true. So we do have a mainstream capability and mainstream sensibilities. The only thing is that especially if you want to be competitive in the workplace, you have to fill a void that is necessary. And so the majority of the clients that are going to hire you from film, television, they're always going to try to hire based on urban engagement, and then you can, when once you establish the relationship, you can go a little bit further and show them that you have a mainstream capability. A lot of people, even after you show it, they don't care. They don't want to see it. They don't want to know about it. They're territorial. They're like, that's my space. So, you know, you just get in where you fit in and you prove the value.
Why is image everything?
I don't personally believe that it is, because the mentality that image is everything completely negates the fact that you have to also be smart and you have to be talented and know what you're doing and not be out there with a great image selling some work that you're not capable of. I think in a lot of ways that's where we've gone wrong with this younger generation, where they think that it's all about the image, and then they're selling themselves for a job that they may not be ready for. And a lot of people just think, oh, yeah, that's not important. Everything that Instagram has given people the impression that the look is all that matters, and that's not true. Like I tell people when I speak to them, Instagram is the storefront, right?
Right.
You can have a beautiful storefront with flowers and roses and you know, luxurious furniture and stuff in the window, making it look fabulous, where people don't know what they're walking into until they go inside. Once you get inside, the walls could be falling apart, the plumbing's falling apart. You don't know what's going on in there. And so it's the same thing. You can make it look good, and I think image does matter, especially as an African-American entrepreneur, but let's never forget that the substance is going to be what keeps you there. Image gets you in the door. Substance keeps you alive.
How did you make that breakthrough into Hollywood?
Let me see. How did that happen? I think that a lot of things, I'm going to go ahead and say, you know, my husband always says things like, you know, you have to speak good things into existence. One of them, I think that's one great example, because I wanted to get into film for at least a year and a half before we did. I kept saying, I want to get into film. I want to get into film. And I kept taking meetings with people to see who can introduce us to the right people and see, you know, what kinds of things we can be doing to prep ourselves to get into film. And there were a lot of people, I will not lie, that were taking me on a ride. Oh, I can make the introductions for you. You know, we could do this and that. But first, I'm going to need you to do this for me. So I was getting no closer. Then we had a former intern in our Atlanta office who met somebody, and she was like, oh, they're in film and they don't have a capability for urban engagement. And she said that they would be interested in having a conversation with us. So I said, great. And then she was like, you know, can we meet with her? I still remember that meeting. I was so uninterested and so like, they want us to do this for free. And she was like, yeah, we don't have a budget. I said, sorry, we don't work for Stardust. We work for money here. And so I remember my intern was like, oh, I want to work on it. Please, you guys won't have to do anything for it. So I was like, all right. So we did it, and then the people who work for us, we trained them well. They knocked it out the park, and then we got another call that her boss went and referred us to the people at Disney. And the people at Disney called and said, I have a film about a white girl with 70 feet of magical blonde hair. It's called Tangled. It's the story of Rapunzel. How am I going to market this to black moms? And so we came up with a killer strategy to identify power in the uniqueness of your hair, and we brought we created a common thread that went in line with the black natural hair revolution that's been happening for years, saying that these black moms can say to their daughters, there's power in the uniqueness of your hair, just like there's power in the uniqueness of Rapunzel's hair. And that went over really well. We got a ton of press, and that's where the first domino fell.
What are the challenges marketers have in your business today? Do they need to constantly seek evolution?
You can't be in marketing and not constantly be changing.
Okay.
Because the media landscape out there for consumers is constantly changing. There was a time when DVDs was the hot new thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when, you know, iPods were the hot new thing. I mean, everything is constantly changing. Change is the only constant. So I think that it's a beautiful thing that we have things like the internet, like, you know, that we have social media, that we have bloggers. These are things that marketers in generations before me did not have. And unfortunately, a lot of people went out of business by fighting change. But we've always been people who love change and love the convenience that it brought. Instead of having to fax press releases and press messages and things like that, social media takes it directly to the consumer for you in a millisecond. I mean, people could only dream about that years ago. And we have it. And so, you know, I'm always appreciative of that.
Who has been a part of your team from the beginning?
Saptosa Foster, my business partner.
And I understand that you all have been together for a long time.
11 years, yes.
What is it about her that she brings to the table?
She is like the yin to my professional yang. Like, I am a very aggressive, nasal-sounding, pushy New Yorker who doesn't really do phony well, or, you know, who is a little bit blunt, a little too blunt for a lot of folks. And so, you know, she definitely is like the person who you roll it in sugar and make it more user-friendly. She makes things more palatable for a lot of people, and when it's a personality conflict, she steps in. She's also the most thorough person I've ever met in my life. This woman lives to make really long lists and tasks, and she blasts through that list of tasks, where I'm more of like the idea, the visionary, the creative, the person who's work focused on business development and brand development.
Shantae Bacon, founder and CEO of 135th Street Agency. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny Johansson Jr. Thank you for joining us today as we begin our 46th season, and please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.